Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
11.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
1, 2.
Midway, the most important of the year.
3, 4.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
It's not 10. You see, you're on 10 here. Where can you go from there? Where?
To 11.
11, exactly.
11.
Midway. So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Talked about a lot today. We heard Robbie Gould talking about a possible return to Chicago, and if Chicago pays him the most money, he probably would do that, is what he said of the Edgar Bennett podcast.
Earl Bennett.
The Manny Machado, Bryce Harper pursuit, the larger picture of baseball labor and what it means for how free agents are being treated, and a potential strike for players trying to claw back some power here, and which is increasingly one-sided.
You call it pending, not potential.
Yeah, as owners have really figured out how much power they have and how to properly wield it. And like you say, the other piece of it is how the fans have gone along accordingly. And we also debated what's happening on the Bears' defensive coaching staff with that amount of turnover, that when it really starts to matter, despite the continuity in player personnel, how those guys in those rooms standing by those overhead projectors are important voices.
All right, this story starts weird and just keeps going, so hold on.
All right.
The man who drove his Ferrari into the Intracoastal in Palm Beach in late December told police he did it because Jesus told me to. That, according to the Palm Beach police report.
When Cody Parkey was removed from the Intracoastal.
On December 26th,
doesn't he live in Florida?
James, yeah, but he didn't do it.
Okay.
A guy named James Mucciaccio.
Okay.
James Mucciaccio of Deerfield Beach was approached by a police officer as he was removing items from his Ferrari, which was parked on a public dock. Mucciaccio told the officer that his friend told him to park on the dock so he could pick him up by boat. When told he could not park on the dock, Mucciaccio apologized and went to retrieve his driver's license from the Italian sports car. Mucciaccio proceeded to reverse off the dock, then put the car in drive and accelerated at high speed into the Palm Beach Inlet. Mucciaccio was able to get out of the car before it sunk and was pulled from the water by two fishermen in a nearby boat. When the officer asked Mucciaccio why he drove into the inlet, he stated, "Jesus told me to drive through a small gate and into a 6-foot window." He also said, "Jesus made me the smartest man on earth. And it's so hard to have this much responsibility. And
I can imagine.
And
it's got to be tough.
Money is going to be irrelevant in 2 days. Remember to smile." He also stated the reason he drove into the inlet. Now, just hold on.
All right. We're not weird yet.
He also stated that the reason he drove into the inlet is because the officer on the dock was Egyptian and he didn't believe in Jesus.
Okay.
Investigation also revealed that the license plate that was attached to the Ferrari belonged to Mucciaccio's Ford Mustang. So, no word on where the Mustang is. It's probably in the bottom of a lake somewhere. Those were all... I didn't make any of that up. The man's name is Mucciaccio.
And just because he's Egyptian doesn't mean he doesn't believe in Jesus.
It doesn't.
You can't assume that.
No, you can't at all. That happened.
That's a day. I want to get
that
back to
that. All happened.
What does he know about money being irrelevant in 2 days?
I don't know. That should be on a t-shirt, though. Heading into spring training, money is irrelevant in 2 days. Remember to smile.
Guess what is increasingly popular in the NBA, and it's about damn time.
Well, wines were already pretty popular.
Yeah, well, we know wine was a huge thing, and is a huge thing. NBA players...
They're now headed for cheeses?
They're headed for pedicures.
No kidding.
And I've always told you, I told you my experience around pro basketball players, veteran pro basketball players, their feet are disgusting and misshapen and mangled because they have been, you know, pounding their feet on hardwood over and over and over again for all their lives. But now NBA players are embracing pedicures. This should have happened a long time ago. Those are your moneymakers, man. That's your.
Does this prevent injury?
No, but it,
pedicures?
It can prevent infection. It can keep the skin healthy.
Cut up your
prevents
toes
blistering.
And, stuff?
And they. This is a Candace Buckner of the Washington Post. There's a deep dive here with a lot of. She knows that DJ Augustine likes his water just so hot, but not too hot.
What?
Wants to feel the exfoliating seaweed scrub on his toes. He advises the pedicurist of his preferred temperature. You guys are doing this at home and on the road. There are favorite salons. There are favorite pedicurists who are being asked to handle certain players at certain times. Shaquille O'Neal helped make this popular. And apparently, patient zero here, there's two. Michael Jordan was one. Michael Jordan made this popular when Evan Turner was young. He said his former agent, David Falk, would share stories of Michael Jordan getting pedicures. And he said that once he heard the story about MJ, his response was, oh, hell yeah, I'm doing that all the time. He wanted to do it every day. He said DeAndre Jordan, when he was a teenager, his mother was nagging him about taking care of his feet. He learned that Terrell Owens got pedicures. So he said, I used to follow Terrell Owens. He was big with that. He said, my feet take care of me, so I've got to take care of my feet. And then Amir Johnson was in L.A. He was a junior in high school, and he walked past a nail salon, and Bernie Mac was getting a pedicure. And he said, Mac's doing it. I'm going to do it. And you think, why not? And now teams are advising that they do it. The team's training staffs are saying, as far as sore calluses, especially guys who wear a new pair of shoes every day, that there are certain, and every set of feet's different, every set of toes, every reaction is different. But why not?
You ever had a pedicure? Or do your decades-old pair of Skechers keep your feet healthy?
No, these are the new ones.
Oh, those are the new ones.
The new ones.
You've transitioned.
I have.
Seamless for you.
See, how would you know?
Have you ever had a pedicure?
No, I had a manicure before my wedding. That's the only manicure I've ever had.
I had a pedicure. Girlfriend and I went. Just, you know, as a thing, what weirded me, it was nice, it was fine, you know, the whole deal.
I don't like feet.
What was weird was that they put whatever it is, like a gloss over your nails, and they're so shiny. It weirded me out every day after the pedicure to see my nails, my feet look that good. It's like, those aren't my feet. My feet are horrible and mangled. There's hair and weird edges and all kinds of snaggletooth going on down there. Why do they look this good?
708 Texter says, I'm a union construction worker. I regularly get pedicures. It's amazing how good your feet feel afterwards.
Well, yeah, it felt great. I mean, it takes all the skin off and whatnot. So we've been following college football for quite a while with Matt Miller and with Pete Futak. And as we wrapped up the season, we were noting that there were a bunch of transfers about to happen. Most have. I was kind of just scrolling around on Twitter, and I found David Hale, who's a college football reporter, kind of put this list together. Of the top five quarterback recruits in the last handful of years, here's how many have transferred. Of the 2000, and this is all kind of brought about because Justin Fields transferred from Georgia to Ohio State.
Trevor Lawrence.
Which led Tate Martell to transfer from Ohio State to Miami. Brandon Wimbush has transferred from Notre Dame to Central Florida. I'm not saying all those guys were top five recruits. I believe Fields and Martell were, but Brandon Wimbush wasn't, if memory serves. However, of the 2018 class, one of the top five has transferred, with probably more to come. In 2017, two of five. In 2016, three of five.
Good for them.
In 2015, four of five, and seven of the top eight.
Let them have some agency.
Class.
If they can't get paid, let them have some agency.
In 2014, three of five. So 13 of the 25 last top five quarterbacks coming into college have transferred. That means it's about a 50% chance, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, depending on how more of these guys transfer. That's the chance you've got of keeping an elite quarterback at your program if you are that college football coach, if you're that guy. It was just kind of seeing it in terms of numbers was striking to me. I knew this was happening. You see the domino effect go on, but 13 of 25, that's a That's a large, large quantity. And good for them.
Yeah.
And I'm glad the transfer rules, too, have been loosened some. You know, that you're going to be able to go and transfer and play right away because your ability to do so has, you've got more loopholes, is essentially, to exploit.
What's worse than your giant fishing boat exploding?
Being on it while it explodes.
Oh, no, you're on it.
Oh, that would be terrible. I can't think of a thing worse.
Well, here's the deal. Four people were trying to escape a boat that had burst into flames off the coast of Sydney. These were fishermen who were on a 34-foot luxury Mariner. They saw smoke coming from the engine room, and then flames quickly engulfed the boat. They put their life jackets on. They contacted New South Wales Maritime as the flames began to overtake the boat. A rescue team was dispatched, and they had their life jackets on. And here's the problem. As they are getting ready to escape, guess what they see in the water?
Sharks.
What was described as a very large shark.
Oh, that's bad.
So, boat's on fire. Huh? Like, and increasingly on fire.
Boat's
like,
on
I mean,
fire.
This is, I mean, really.
Our boat.
Yeah.
Boat goes into the water. Yeah. Shark in the water.
Shark in the water.
Fire in the water.
Yeah, fire. Need a bigger boat. But indeed, they had no choice. The fire was so bad, they did jump in the water as the fiberglass boat was completely engulfed. The large shark swam past.
Huh.
This is the, he said, the boating safety officer and the men saw the large shark swim past, described the rescue as a miracle. There was an electrical fault in the engine compartment. That's what's left of the boat, by the way.
But that's nothing. That's what you're showing me the picture.
It's a shard of fiberglass.
That's nothing.
I said black plumes of smoke could be seen from locations around the harbor as the section of the boat washed ashore at South Head. The company that insures the boat will be responsible for collecting what's left of the wreck from the shore. But file that one under Australia, that there when you're fishing and your boat's on fire and you want to jump in the water, don't jump in the water. There's something waiting for you.
Apropos of that story, I saw a movie last night, Dan. I realized that this movie review comes in a little late, but it should have never happened at all.
The movie or the review?
Both. I saw Aquaman last night.
Oh.
Not only is it an absolute mess with very little theme or sense of self, not only is it horribly acted and terribly written, but it's the most ridiculous, psychedelic mix of visuals that have ever been put into a superhero movie. And I saw Green Lantern.
Right.
Like, this was
in
complete,
itself a mess.
A complete and utter failure. I spent the second half of the movie debating with myself whether or not this or Green Lantern was a worse movie, and not really coming out with a decisive thought one way or the other, because both were so, so bad. It's amazing to me that this movie has made as much money as it has. And it's exactly because nerds like me go see it for $10 on Discount Tuesdays because they don't have anything else to do on an afternoon where the Bulls play at 9:30. And we'll get to them, speaking of train wreck. It was awful. The only redeeming factor in this movie was Jason Momoa's charisma, of which there is some, but there is no acting ability there whatsoever, so you're bound watching that for the rest of your time. It's horrendous. DC keeps getting chances to make these movies because I'm doing what I'm doing and everybody else who has gone to see the movie just flipped the $10 over that way to see if maybe they could come up with something like Wonder Woman. They didn't. So we're left at the end of the movie. We're walking outside talking about just how bad it is. And do you know how quickly the conversation changed from how bad that movie is to how good the Marvel Universe is? Instantly.
Is it the...
Absolutely, instantly.
Is there something about underwater movies that don't involve submarines?
Which ones don't involve
I'm
submarines?
I'm just thinking like Waterworld and like the...
Yeah, but that wasn't an underwater movie. He spent all of that time above water. Yeah, most of it.
The Abyss was bad. I'm trying to draw some commonality.
The Abyss was
here.
Okay.
Not a little mermaid guy?
It's fine.
It was animated. You get to do... It wasn't this... There was this weird... So they're underwater the whole time. Their hair is just kind of like floating around, obviously done in computer graphics. And their heads are all just kind of like bobbing around the entire time in this weird CG effect to make it look like they're, you know, really kind of floating underwater. It was so jarring and awful. I mean, it was... It was one of the three worst movies I've ever seen.
I never, ever considered for a moment seeing Aquaman. I just don't think you can. He's not an interesting superhero.
He's not.
He's not
his
interesting.
His power is to talk to fish.
Right.
His power is to talk. And he, does he talk to fish?
Really?
So many fish. Honestly, you could go through that movie and count.
Yeah, who else can?
Abs versus that fish in that movie. There are. It's a contest between the two of them.
I like to see him talk to a plate of lox. Right? Just sitting here. He's just,
so, bad day?
He's how's it going? Okay. Yeah. Can he talk to the capers, too? Or is it?
I'm unaware.
Talk to Dom Capers, perhaps.
It'd be more interesting to watch than what he did.
Okay. Least. Now, here we go. This is going to blow your mind. I am not a ketchup on McDonald's fries guy.
Why?
I'm just not.
I don't eat a lot of ketchup, but when I have fries, I drench them in ketchup.
I do not, and occasionally I'll get a taste. My favorite thing in ketchup is Gene and Georgetti's onion strings.
The favorite thing in the world of ketchup. No, let's introduce those squeeze bottles.
Favorite thing to place in ketchup.
Okay,
if like the Hackney's onion rings. Gene and Georgetti's onion rings, those things, all the Heinz ketchup in the world, and they're a perfect vehicle for that. But not McDonald's fries, because for me, the McDoubles have enough ketchup on them to satisfy my ketchup taste, and it works that way. If you like McDonald's fries and ketchup, did you know that rather than messing with your packets and like getting a napkin or something or in the car,
it's always
gross, what to
do, and it leaks through everything.
Who knew? That flap, that one oversized flap on the fry container, is designed to be folded down 90 degrees and used as a ketchup container.
You are kidding.
It is a ketchup platform. You order fries from McDonald's or any other fast food restaurant that has the similarly shaped box. You hold the box steadily in one hand. You fold the taller side of the fry box down until it's horizontal. Squeeze your ketchup onto the horizontal flap and dip.
You're blowing my mind, Frank.
I told you. I would never have thought of it. A life hack if you are a fries with ketchup person.
I get the innovation. That's awesome. That's just for guys like me who drench the fries in ketchup. That's not enough space to put ketchup on. That's my problem, though. You know, I have some stuff to go napkin. I get six or seven of those little cups of ketchup for each one because I don't want to work too hard to get to the bottom of the ketchup.
You're talking about the pleated paper cups?
Those are the ones.
Okay.
Those are the ones. Yeah, I get about halfway through one of those and I go on to the next one because I don't want to work that hard.
Maybe you're just at the airport or something. You want to grab some fries. You'll walk to the gate. There you go.
Can I get my hash browns in that? Because it's always very difficult to run around. Can I put my hash browns in the fry box and then go that way?
Catch up on hash browns.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's my every morning flight out of O'Hare. I'm there for two hash browns and a coffee and then walking up to the flight.
I'm a barbecue sauce on my fries guy if your place has solid barbecue sauce. It's good.
I hadn't thought of this. There was a restaurant, I think they've redone the restaurant, but growing up, one of my favorite places in the world was in Northbrook Court, the original Claim Company. And it was a burger place. It was like a custom burger. It's like when Salad Bar got popular in the early 80s after RJ Grunts did the Salad Bar thing. It was just a perfect restaurant for big groups and kids, and their burgers were outstanding. The other thing that everybody got, deep-fried zucchini wedges.
Oh, yeah, that's in a
heavy breadcrumb batter. Yeah. With a really tangy, spicy, regular barbecue sauce. That's living, man. Really good deep-fried zucchini and that barbecue sauce on there. Fries, not so much, but that's pretty good. Hey, when we come back, that is the Midday Midway, by the way. Got some information about a reported value of the White Sox offer to Manny Machado.
Well, hello.
Yeah, we've got another national reporter weighing in with what is some apparently actual solid information about what the White Sox Machado offer is.
That'll be next. Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
For me, it can get worrisome at the point where there's false information out there that may influence fan perception. But at the same time, I know that at some point, these matters will be resolved and we'll be able to speak a little more candidly about how we viewed things and how we approach things and what it means for us going forward. So it's perhaps temp, but you know, certainly how fans perceive and respond to such things is relevant. And we're aware of it.
Rick Hahn talking about what's real, what's not, what we know, and what we don't regarding the White Sox pretty public pursuit of a major free agent. The bottom of the hour brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. Allstate Arena tonight, 7 p.m. The Chicago Wolves host Grand Rapids in a battle for the first place in the American Hockey League's Central Division. Visit ChicagoWolves.com for tickets and join in the quest to be the last team standing. According to ESPN's Buster Olney, the White Sox offer to Manny Machado is 7 years, $175
million. 125 divided by 7.
175.
What did I do? 175 divided by 7.
25 per.
Gets you to $25 million a year.
Either the market is suppressed beyond what I thought, or that is not enough to get Manny Machado.
If that's the number, it goes to exactly what we were talking about before we talked to Ian Happ in the 10 o'clock hour. There are going to be fan bases up in arms with pitchforks and torches if they're not in on that guy at $25 million a year. That's what? Jacoby Ellsbury money? Listen, if you're there with that offer, and I don't know whether that's really where they're at or not. If you're able to just sit back and wait, if you're the high bidder there, then we're here for a long time.
If that's the market, your union leadership right now, there should be alarm bells going off in union offices right now. Absolutely alarm bells. You should have your most powerful people, Tony Clark and all of his lieutenants, need to be, if not getting ready to file a lawsuit, getting ready to ask some very, very tough questions about how this is happening, because that reeks of collusion.
What precedents are being cited here? That's what I'd be – I mean, you have the Jason Hayward contract and the inherent risk that teams are taking in signing a deal that long and large. But that's not – I mean, he's 26 years old. Both of them are. The idea that they're not worth – the idea that teams aren't willing to pony up and pay what you would otherwise have to. Kyler Murray is asking for $15 million as a guy who's never played Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And the A's would like to give it to him. They don't want to cave. They don't want to sacrifice any of the negotiating power or leverage. And MLB would rather them not give the $15 million. But listen, Yoan Moncada got $31 million to sign without playing a single game in Major League Baseball for the Boston Red Sox. Then
look at the posting fees for Japanese players. Go to Shohei
Ohtani. Then the Red Sox paid another $31 million to go over their international signing bonus to sign Yoan Moncada. This is suppression, if that's where we're at.
Okay, if that's where
the market, and it's not even a White Sox thing.
Any team,
if you're the Padres, for
that money? $175 million over 7 years for a 26-year-old shortstop / third baseman? Come on.
It's almost like that money can't go bad. You know what I'm saying? It's almost
like at age 34?
You're signing yourself a Chris Sale deal or a Jose Quintana deal where all they've got to do is get out there and perform to average, and you've got yourself a good contract.
If that's the market number, how can the Yankees, Cubs, Dodgers, all these teams not be lining up?
I'll tell you what, if the White Sox have sniffed out where the top end of the market is and set themselves right there, you know, perched on top, that's incredible work. It is. It's incredible work. And they'll know, you know, at 7 years on $175 million, that you could go up from there.
Sure.
And I think Lozano will know that. I think Boris will know that when it comes to Bryce Harper, that those offers can increase. But if you've pegged a marketplace, if you figured, and the White Sox have every incentive to be the first name mentioned when you get to Manny Machado's free agency. I mean, what's the one consistent, too, maybe, it's the White Sox and Phillies have been in, and the Phillies are tamped some, or watered down a little bit because they've got Harper involved in some of their rumors as well. But you have always, almost always, heard Manny Machado's name connected to the White Sox. There's a reason for that.
And we're making an assumption here. we're sort of jumping to this, that we are, and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, because, and texters are bringing this up too, saying it's possible that this is true, that the Sox offer, according that Buster only reports, is 175 over 7. It also could be true that they're way below what the actual market is, and it could be a low ball offer. So we are, but my assumption is the Sox are in this enough that I will give them the benefit of the doubt. I will treat
that's
this,
the sense of it. I get
everything what we've heard that they are they're not screwing around and they're not doing this just as a dog and pony show.
No, they almost can't, because if that offer, now that that offer is out there in a very real way. And look, Bruce had something close to that like Monday, Tuesday, something. If they're out there now and then they get blown out of the water, if the Yankees come in with stupid money, if the Phillies come in with the stupid money that their owner promised to spend, what are you left with? You're left with a fallout there. That's the one thing you really can't be, is left with the fallout of not being competitive enough when you've got every reason and every ability to be competitive in that offer.
And Bruce Levine had it. He said 7 years at 25 to 28 per year. This is 7 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Hey, when we come back, you get another chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score. This hour's keyword. Whoop! I almost said it, but I'm not going to. I was looking at it, and I almost
way to hold yourself back.
Well,
there.
I'm not allowed That's to impressive. Say it before the,
no, I know.
The actual time, but I caught myself before I said it. And at some point, we have to get to. I wouldn't call him a person in sports, but he's been tangentially connected to sports. One of the worst human beings on the planet might finally be out of a job.
Oh,
might finally be out of a job.
That's good.
Mark Schanowski,
one of the best people in sports,
just
around town.
Lowly Bulls. He joins us next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Hey, Schanowski, I heard what you said.
Mark Schanowski.
I've seen a handful of different times where there was video of him lighting up Jamokes in pickup games.
NBC Sports Chicago Bulls pre- and post-game host.
Mr. Carter to you.
The most interesting man in the world.
I'm coming for you, man. You heard it here first.
Mark Schanowski with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Mark Schanowski's on Twitter, at Mark Schanowski. You can see him at NBC Sports Chicago as your Bulls host, and he joins us now on the Bernstein and McKnight show. The Bulls fall again, this time to the Lakers without LeBron James. And I'm not sure what conclusions to draw from what I was able to see last night before I had to hit the hay. What was meaningful to you?
Well, I think the most fun was at the end when they denied the LA fans the free tacos by getting to 100. They scored 21 points in the last couple of minutes and got to 100. Obviously, it has no impact on the long-term rebuild, but that was at least fun to watch for those who stayed until the bitter end. As far as the bulk of the game, though, you know, same issues. Issues on transition defense, confusion on options on offense. You know, there's problems all over the court. And, you know, when you put your finger in the dike to plug one, there's a hole that, you know, spouts somewhere else. So just a team that is, you know, your classic NBA struggling team, problems all over the court and no apparent answers right now.
It still feels, Mark, like Jim Boylan is trying to strangle out Lauri Markkanen with how he's trying to use him on offense. It's just, I mean, I was watching the second quarter, and he got a touch early and got a shot up in some, you know, ISO low block kind of thing. Like they'll run, they'll spread four to the other side of the four and let Lowry kind of work his thing. And I didn't see him touch the ball offensively for another 6, 7, 8 minutes. I mean, it felt like forever. How is that developing the young core? How is Lowry Markkanen supposed to be used in this offense that he's not getting to his spot, or that he's not making shots that he wants to, or shooting shots that he wants to shoot?
Well, most of the plays that they run involving Lowry involve him setting a screen up near the top of the key, and then he pops out for a three-point shot, or else there's some misdirection where the ball is on one side, and then they run a screen where Lowry gets a three on the other side. It's really kind of a shame for a guy that's that athletic at 7 feet tall to use him basically as a standstill shooter, and that's kind of his role in this offense right now. And most of it's on the structure of the offense, but part of it, too, is on Lowry himself. He's you know, he bragged in the summer about how he put on 15 pounds of muscle and he was going to be able to punish smaller defenders in the post. He has to demand the ball in the post. He has to get his butt down there, and when he gets the opportunity, he has to score. We saw a couple occasions last night where even when he got the ball down deep,
he would do the Dirk step back and fall away instead of trying to shoot right over a guy who's 5, 6, 7 inches shorter than he is. Lowry's still learning how to play in the post, and that's something that a skill that he's going to have to acquire if he's going to reach the potential that the Bulls and everyone else is hoping he will.
Is Jim Boylan seeing what you're seeing? These things seem so obvious to us, but this is there's some of these inefficient shots are a part of his offense, and I'm not sure if the way we view something as a good or bad shot is the way the Bulls are currently.
Well, what happens when a team is struggling, you know, now they have an 8-game losing streak, and I think that a lot of times you get situations where guys are just looking for their turn, and I saw a lot of that last night, where players would just decide, hey, I haven't shot in a while, it's my turn to shoot. Zach had a really poor game last night. He took some really questionable shots, and in the second half he kind of really took himself right out of it mentally and wasn't a factor at all in the game. Chris Dunn at times will just drive into the paint with no apparent end game in mind and either make a bad decision going to the rim or turn the ball over. And I think what happens is guys just start looking around and saying, it's my turn. And now Jabari is back in the rotation, and he's going to take his shots when they present themselves. So it's really not a recipe for development when you have a number of individuals thinking that, you know, it's a my-turn system. And you're not going to get much accomplished in the NBA unless you're the Golden State Warriors who have premier talent.
Chris Dunn is 8 of 27 from the field in his past three games. I was just reading that in a Darnell Mayberry piece. And I wonder, you know, you mentioned his kind of meandering possessions, driving to the lane and going nowhere. Boylan pulled him last night in the second and fairly early on in the second in favor of Ryan Arcidiacono. Do you, I worry some because of the little mutiny that happened early
just
on.
A little bit.
I worry about those kind of disciplinary actions in games, even if they're warranted, coming back to bite a guy that had players turn on him after he wanted him to run suicides.
Well, in the pregame show last night, we decided, you know, the way things are going, we'd have a little bit of fun. And we ran a clip from the Meet the Parents film with the Robert De Niro character talking about the circle of trust. And that's really what it's become. You have to be in Jim Boylan's circle of trust in order to see the floor and to be used in a meaningful way. And now Robin Lopez is out of the circle of trust, and he'll sit at the end of the bench and kind of scowl on the baseline. And you've got Jabari Parker back in for who knows how long until I'm sure they're trying to showcase him for a possible trade. He'll pull guys. You know, Wendell Carter Jr. has been yanked early in games because the coach didn't like the way, like his mental edge. Chris Dunn, as you mentioned, pulled last night because he wasn't doing things exactly the way that the coach had wanted. And you know, this is framed under the guise of creating a new culture and showing guys that they have to do things the way the coach expects them to do in order to see the court. And that is that's what they've basically given Jim Boylan the mission to do, is to create a culture to teach these young guys that they have to earn their playing time. And that's all well and good, but sometimes it seems to be done in a haphazard way, and then you wonder if the message is really being sent, if guys are moving in and out of that circle of trust.
It's arbitrary and random, and then when they're out there, I don't claim to be super conversant in NBA analytics, but I do understand when you look at some of these heat maps about where the efficient shots are taken, that where teams are looking to score more points than their opponent. There's bad areas on the floor. There are little slack water areas where two-point field goals are made, often contested two-point field goals. And it seems like Bulls players are finding the worst spots to be in at the worst times. Late in the shot clock, in these inefficient, contested two areas, occasionally two guys in the same spot. This is not hard, and this is not advanced stuff. If I'm noticing it, there have to be people on that bench, there have to be people in the organization wondering what the plan is to have the Bulls do smarter things offensively, things that make sense. And when do they get to do that?
Well, one thing that's become abundantly clear during the 8-game losing streak is they don't have any three-point shooting. You know, they traded Justin Holiday to Memphis, and even though his percentage wasn't great, he was a fairly efficient three-point shooter, and now they're trying to get that from Lowry and to a lesser extent from Zach LaVine. And you know, they're just not in all the losses. They're getting outscored by such a wide margin from the three-point line that it's almost impossible to make that up in other areas. You know, they talk about trying to dominate points in the paint and get to the free throw line, but 3 points is always better than two. And in today's NBA, just about every team has two or three above-average three-point shooters, and the Bulls at this point don't have any. And that's something, when you look ahead to the summer and possible trades and free agency, they've got to add some shooting because it's something that's really been dragging them down. And as you said, too often late in the shot clock, you've got the ball in either Zach or Lowry's hands, and they're inside the arc, and they're forced to take a contested two, which, as we all know, is the worst shot in basketball right now.
Some of this is on the guys on the floor, I think. And in two more shot clock violations last night against the Lakers, one of them is definitely on, I believe it's Markkanen. He just kind of gets lost at the top of the free throw line extended and just isn't looking around for a shot. Is some of that to you confusion in what they're being asked to do? Is there a checkout factor there? What of the shot clock violations?
Well, I think the system is pretty clear. You know, they're trying to play old school inside out basketball, getting it in the post and cutting off the big man, which, you know, in today's NBA is almost archaic. And what that's going to happen if you don't get anything off the initial actions, shot clock's going to run under 10, and then you're kind of scrambling to get a usable shot, especially since Wendell Carter Jr. at this point in his development really is a little bit wary to try to create his own shot in the low post. So you've got a lot of possessions that kind of get bogged down, and then what ends up happening is you throw the ball out to the guard or you throw it out to Lowry, and they're forced to try to create something with the shot clock running down on them. So, you know, one of the things we talked about in the postgame show was that they did outscore the Lakers in fast break points yesterday, 23-15. They've got a young group of athletes out there on the floor. They need to run more to create more easy opportunity baskets because with the current roster – and with what they're being asked to do, that's their best way to stay in games, is to try to get some steals, try to get in the open court and score on the fast break before the defense sets up. And I think that's something we'll see more of in the coming weeks.
What's the latest on the trade front for either Robin Lopez or Parker?
Well, I don't think they're going to be able to find a trade for Robin Lopez. He's making $14.3 million, and they don't want to take any money back that extends beyond this year. So I think Lopez will be with the team in this role where he's just kind of watching from the sideline until the February 7th trade deadline passes. And then I think they will, honor him as a veteran who's been a good soldier and buy him out, let him go to hopefully kind of try to jump on with a contending team. The Jabari thing now is getting a little bit more interesting because, you know, we all know about his defensive deficiencies, but in the last two games that he's had a chance to play, he's looked pretty good. You know, he scored 29 points over the last two games. He's scored in a variety of ways, and I think there's a lot of teams that would like to add that one more piece for the playoffs or, you know, in the situation where some teams are looking to get rid of expiring contracts and might want something different. You know, there was speculation about a three-way trade involving the Knicks and the Sacramento Kings. The Knicks are desperate to get off Enes Kanter. Sacramento is thinking they might have a chance to make the playoffs. They may take Kanter as a guy who can score. The Bulls could get back some combination of Zach Randolph and Kosta Kufis, which would do nothing for you on the court, but it would find Jabari a new home.
Wendell wow. Carter's thumb, is that a thing we ought to be worried about here for the young man, or are we hearing that that's more of just a precautionary situation?
Yeah, at this point, it's just precautionary, but, you know, anybody who's played basketball, you got to sprain thumb, sprain fingers. It's tough to play at 100% efficiency, but you know, the great thing about being 19 is you heal pretty quickly. So, you know, the thought is I think he's going to be okay. Right now, they got to find a way to scratch out a win. They play at Cleveland Monday on the Martin Luther King holiday. So that's their chance to get in the win column because right now, you know, we heard about the scrap with Robin Lopez and Chris Dunn in practice the other day. And I think that was mostly a product of Lopez finding out before practice he was out of the rotation and just took out some of his frustrations. But anytime a team is on a long losing streak and their prospects don't look good, you worry about, you know, things like that happening. And right now the onus on the coaching staff is to try to find a way to get a win, to try to play at a faster pace, and hopefully get a happier group of guys to take the court.
Mark, thank you.
All right, we've got the game tomorrow. They're in Denver to close out the trip via 7:30 pregame on NBC Sports Chicago. So we'll see what happens tomorrow night.
That is Mark Schanowski, always candid Bulls opinions. And now it's time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score. The keyword is beef. Text beef to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is beef to 72881. A randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please don't text and drive. Message and data rates may apply.
Hub Arkish returns.
Yes.
He is ours when we come back. He'll be yours tomorrow. We'll talk NFL playoffs. We'll wrap things up with the Bears, too, as they lose another defensive coach. Hub Arkish on 670. The score is next. Princeton McKnight.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.